The keep of the landsmen of Theos was a grim, martial place that lay well away from the island's towns and villages, in a narrow, secluded valley of its own. It was close to the sea, but shielded from it by a solid wall of mountains. By land, only two roads gave approach, and both were fortified by landsguard. A stone watchtower stood atop the tallest peak, a high sentinel for all the paths leading to the keep. The fortress itself was old and stern, built of great blocks of weathered black stone. Its back was to the mountain, and Maris knew from her last visit that much of it lay underground, in chambers chiselled from solid rock. Its exterior face showed a double set of wide walls. Landsguard, armed with longbows, walked patrol on the parapets, ringing a cluster of wooden buildings and two black towers, the taller of which was almost 50 feet high. Stout wooden bars closed off the tower windows. The valley, so close to the sea, was damp and cold. The only ground cover was a tenacious violet lichen and a blue-green moss that clung to the underside of boulders and half-covered the walls of the keep. Coming up the road from Thossi, Maris and Evan were stopped once at the valley checkpoint, passed, stopped again at the outer wall, and finally admitted to the keep. They might have been detained longer, but Maris was carrying her bright silver wings, and Landsguard did not trifle with flyers. The inner courtyard was full of activity. Children playing with great shaggy dogs, fierce-looking pigs running everywhere, Landsguard drilling with bow and club. A gibbet had been built against one wall, its wood cracked and well-weathered. The children played all about it, and one of them was using a noose as a swing. The other two nooses hung empty, twisting ominously in the chill wind of evening. "This place oppresses me," Maris told Evan. "The landsman of Lesser Amberley lives in a huge wooden manor on a hill overlooking the town. It has 20 guest rooms and a tremendous banquet hall, and wonderful windows of coloured glass, and a beacon tower for summoning flyers, but it has no walls and no guards, and no gibbets."
"The landsman of Lesser Amberley is chosen by the people," Evan said. "The landsman of Theos is from a line that has ruled here since the days of the Star Sailors. And you forget, Maris, that Eastern is not as gentle a land as Western. Winter lasts longer here. Our storms are colder and fiercer. Our soil has more metal, but it is not so good for growing things as the soil in the West. Famine and war are never very far away on Theos."
They passed through a massive gate down into the interior of the keep, and Maris fell silent. The landsman met them in his private reception chamber, seated on a plain wooden throne and flanked by two sour-faced landsguard. But he rose when they entered. Landsmen and flyers were equal.
"I'm pleased you could accept my invitation, flyer," he said. "There was some concern about your health."
Despite the polite words, Maris did not like him. The landsman was a tall, well-proportioned man, with regular, almost handsome features, his grey hair worn long and knotted behind his head, in the Eastern fashion. But there was something disturbing about his manner, and he had a puffiness around his eyes and a twitch at the corner of his mouth that his full beard did not quite conceal. His dress was rich and sombre. Thick blue-grey cloth, trimmed with black fur, thigh-high boots, a wide leather belt inlaid with iron and silver and gemstones, and he wore a small metal dagger.
"I appreciate your concern," Maris replied. "I was badly injured, but I've recovered my health now. You have a great treasure here on Theos in Evan. I've met many healers, but few as skilled as he."
The landsman sank back into his chair.
"He will be well rewarded," he said,
as if Evan was not even present.
"Good work deserves a good reward, eh?"
"I will pay Evan myself," Maris said. "I have sufficient iron."
"No," the landsman insisted. "Your near death in my service gave me great distress. Let me show my gratitude."
"I pay my own debts," Maris said.
The landsman's face grew cold.
"Very well," he said. "There is another matter we must discuss then, but let it wait for dinner." Your walk must have left you hungry.
He stood up abruptly.
Come, then. You'll find I set a good table, Flyer. I doubt you've ever had better.
As it turned out, Maris had eaten better on countless occasions. The food was plentiful, but badly prepared. The fish soup was far too salty, the bread was hard and dry, and the meat courses had all been boiled until even the memory of taste had fled. Even the beer tasted sour to her. They ate in a dim, damp banquet hall at a long table set for 20. Evan, looking desperately uncomfortable, was placed well down the table among several Landsguard officers and the landsman's younger children. Maris occupied a position of honour at the landsman's side, next to his heir, a sharp-faced, sullen woman who did not speak three words during the entire meal. Across from her, the other flyers were seated. Closest to the landsman was a weary, grey-faced man with a bulbous nose. Maris recognised him vaguely from past encounters as the flyer Jem. Third down was Corina of Lesser Amberley. She smiled at Maris across the table. Corina was terribly pretty, Maris thought, remembering what the runner had said. But then her father, Corm, had always been handsome.
"You look well, Maris," Corina said. "I'm glad. We were very worried about you."
"I am well," Maris said. "I hope to be flying again soon." A shadow passed across Corina's pretty face.
"Maris," she started, then she thought better. "I hope so," she finished weakly. "Everyone asks about you. We'd like you home again."
She looked down and occupied herself with her meal. Between Jem and Corina sat the third flyer, a young woman strange to Maris. After an abortive attempt to start a conversation with the landsman's daughter, Maris fell to studying the stranger over her food. She was the same age as Corina, but the contrast between the two women was marked. Corina was vibrant and beautiful, dark hair, clean, healthy skin, green eyes, sparkling and alive, and an air of confidence and easy sophistication. A flyer, daughter of two flyers, born and raised to the privileges and traditions that went with the wings. The woman next to her was thin, though she had a look of stubborn strength about her. Pockmarks covered her hollow cheeks, and her pale blonde hair was knotted in an awkward lump behind her head and pulled back in such a way as to make her forehead seem abnormally high. When she smiled, Maris saw that her teeth were crooked and discoloured. "You're Tia, aren't you?" she said. The woman regarded her with shrewd black eyes. "I am." Her voice was startlingly pleasant, cool and soft, with a faint ironic undertone. "I don't think we've ever met," Maris said. "Have you been flying long?"
"I won my wings 2 years ago on North Erin."
Maris nodded.
"I missed that one. I think I was on a mission to Artelia. Have you ever flown to Weston?"
3 times, Tia replied. "Twice to Big Showdown and once to Cullhall. Never to the Amberleys. Most of my flying has been in Eastern, especially these days."
She gave her landsman a quick, sharp glance from the corner of her eyes and smiled a conspiratorial smile at Maris.
Corina, who'd been listening, tried to be polite.
"What did you think of Stormtown?" she asked. "And the Eyrie? Did you visit the Eyrie?"
Tia smiled tolerantly. "I'm a one-wing," she said. "I trained at Air Home. We don't go to your Eyrie, Flyer.
As to Stormtown, it was impressive. There's no city like it in Easton."
Corina flushed. Maris was briefly annoyed. The friction between flyers born to wings and the upstart one-wings depressed her. The skies of Windhaven were not the friendly place they had once been, and much of that was her doing.
"The Eyrie isn't such a bad place, Tia," she said. "I've made a lot of friends there."
"You're not a one-wing," Tia said.
"Oh?"
"Val One-Wing himself once told me I was the first one-wing, whether I admitted it or not."
Tia looked at her speculatively.
"No," she said finally. "No, that ain't right. You're different, Maris. Not one of the old flyers, but not a one-wing either. I don't know what you are. Must be lonely, though."
They finished the meal in a strained, awkward silence. When the dessert cups had been cleared away,
The landsman dismissed family, councillors, and landsguard, so only the four flyers and Evan remained. He tried to dismiss Evan as well, but the healer would not go.
"Maris is still in my care," he said. "I stay with my patient."
The landsman gave him an angry stare, but elected not to press the point.
"Very well," he snapped. "We have business to discuss. Flyer business."
He turned his hot eyes on Maris.
"I will be direct. I received a message from my colleague, the landsman of Lesser Amberley. He inquires after your health. Your wings are needed. When will you be well enough to return to Amberley?"
"I don't know," Maris said. "You can see that I've recovered, but the flight from Deos to Amberley is taxing for any flyer, and I do not have my full strength back yet. I will depart Deos as soon as I can."
"A long flight," the flyer Jem agreed, "especially for one who does not make even short flights."
"Yes," the landsman said. "You and the healer have done a lot of walking. You seem healthy again. Your wings are repaired, I'm told. Yet you do not fly. You have never come to the Flyer's Cliff. You do not practice. Why?"
"I'm not ready," Maris said.
"Landsman," said Jem, "it is as I told you.
She has not recovered, no matter how it seems. If she were able, she would be flying."
He shifted his gaze to her.
"I'm sorry if I hurt you," he said, "but you know I speak the truth. I'm a flyer, too, I know. A flyer flies. There is no way to keep a healthy flyer on the ground. And you, you're no ordinary flyer. They used to tell me that you loved flying above all else."
"I did," said Maris. "I do."
"Landsman," Evan began. Maris turned her head to look at him.
"No, Evan," she said. "The burden isn't yours. I will tell them." She faced the landsman again.
"I'm not entirely recovered," she admitted. "My balance. There is something wrong with my balance. But it is healing. It is not so bad as it once was. I'm sorry," Tia said quickly.
Jem nodded. "Oh, Maris," Karina said. She looked grief-stricken, suddenly close to tears. Karina had none of her father's malice, and she knew what balance meant to a flyer.
"Can you fly?" the landsman said.
"I don't know," Maris admitted. "I need more time."
"You've had time enough," he said.
He turned to Evan.
"Healer, can you tell me that she will recover?"
"No," Evan said sadly. "I cannot tell you that. I do not know."
The landsman scowled.
"This affair belongs to the landsman of Lesser Amberley, but the burden is on me. And I say that a flyer who cannot fly is no flyer at all and has no need of wings. If your recovery is that uncertain, only a fool would wait for it. I ask you again, Maris, can you fly?"
His eyes were fixed on her, and the corner of his mouth moved in a malicious little twitch, and Maris knew she had run out of time.
"I can fly," she said.
"Good," the landsman said. "Tonight is as good as any other time. You say you can fly? Very well. Get your wings. Show us."
The walk through the damp, dripping tunnel was as long as Maris remembered it, and as lonely, though this time she had company. No one talked. The only sound was the echo of their footsteps. Two landsguard walked ahead of the party with torches. The flyers wore their wings. It was a cold, starry night on the far side of the mountain. The sea moved restlessly below them, a vast, dark, melancholy presence. Maris climbed the stairs to the flyer's cliff. She climbed slowly, and when she reached the top, her thighs ached and her breathing was labored. Evan took her hand briefly.
"Can I persuade you not to fly?"
"No," she said. He nodded.
"I thought not. Fly well, then."
He kissed her and stepped away. The landsman stood against the cliff, flanked by his landsguard. Tia and Jem unfolded her wings. Karina hung back until Maris called to her.
"I'm not angry," Maris said. This is not your doing. A flyer isn't responsible for the messages she bears.
Thank you, Karina said. Her small, pretty face was pale in the starlight.
If I fail, you are to bring my wings back to Amberley, yes?
Karina nodded reluctantly.
Do you know what the landsman intends to do with them?
He will find a new flyer, perhaps someone who has lost his wings by challenge. Until someone is found, well, Mother is ill, but Father is still fit enough to fly.
Maris laughed lightly. There's a wonderful irony in that. Corm has always wanted my wings, but I'm going to do my best to keep them from him once again.
Karina smiled. Her wings were fully extended. Maris could feel the familiar, insistent push of the wind against them. She checked her straps and struts, motioned Karina out of her way, and walked to the brink of the precipice. There she steadied herself and looked down. The world reeled dizzily, drunkenly. Far below, breakers crashed against black rocks, sea and stone locked in eternal war. She swallowed hard and tried to keep from lurching off the cliff. Slowly, the world grew solid and steady again. No motion. It was just a cliff, like any other cliff, and below, the endless ocean. The sky was her friend, her lover. Maris flexed her arms and took the wing grips in hand. Then she took a deep breath and leapt. Her kick sent her clean away from the cliff, and the wind grabbed her, supporting her. It was a cold, strong wind, a wind that cut through to the bone, but not an angry wind, no, an easy wind to fly. She relaxed and gave herself to it, and she glided down and around in a long, graceful curve. But the current pushed around again toward the mountain, and Maris glimpsed the landsman and the other flyers waiting there. Jem had unfolded his own wings and was preparing to launch, before she decided to turn away from them. She twisted her body, tried to bank. The sky lurched and turned fluid on her. She banked too far, stalled, and when she tried to correct by throwing her weight and strength back in the other direction, she tilted wildly, her breath caught in her throat. The feel was gone. Maris closed her eyes for an instant and felt sick. She was falling. Her body screamed at her. She was falling. Her ears rang, and the feel was gone from her. She'd always known. Subtle changes in the winds, shifts she had to react to before she was half aware of them, the taste of a building storm, the omens of still air. Now it was all gone. She flew through an endless, empty ocean of air, feeling nothing. Dizzy, and the strange, savage wind she could not understand had her in its grasp. Her great silver wings tilted back and forth wildly as her body shook, and Maris opened her eyes again, suddenly desperate. She steadied herself and tried to fly on vision alone, but the rocks moved, and it was too dark, and even the bright, cold stars above seemed to dance and shift and mock her. Vertigo reached up and swallowed her whole, and Maris released her wing grips. She'd never done that before, never. And now she was not flying, but only hanging beneath her wings. She doubled over in the straps, retching, and sent the landsman's dinner down into the ocean. She was trembling violently. Jem and Karina were both airborne and coming after her, Maris saw, but she did not care. She was weak, drained, old. There were boats below her, gliding across the black ocean. She took her wing grips in hand again, tried to pull up, but all she accomplished was a sharp downwind turn that sheared into a plunge. She tried to correct and couldn't. She was crying. The sea came up at her, shimmering, shifting. Her ears hurt. She could not fly. She was a flyer, had always been a flyer. Wind lover, wood winger, sky child, alone, home in the sky. Flyer, 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 and she could not fly. She closed her eyes again so the world would stand still. With a slap and a spray of salt water, the sea took her. It has been waiting, she thought, all those years. "Leave me alone," she said that night when they finally returned to his home. Evan took her at her word. Maris slept most of the next day. The following day Maris woke early when the ruddy light of dawn first broke across the room. She felt terrible, cold and sweaty, and a great weight pressed across her chest. For a moment she could not think what was wrong. Then she remembered. Her wings were gone. She tried to think about it, and the despair welled up inside her, and the anger, and the self-pity, and soon she curled up under the blankets once again and tried to go back to sleep. When she slept, she did not have to face it. But sleep would not take her. Finally, she rose and dressed. Evan was in the next room, cooking eggs. "Hungry?" he asked her. "No," Maris said dully. Evan nodded and cracked two more eggs. Maris sat at the table, and when he set a plate of eggs before her, she picked at them listlessly. It was a wet, windy day, marked by frequent violent storms. When he had finished his breakfast, Evan went about his business. Near noon he left her, and Maris wandered aimlessly through the empty house. Finally, she sat by the window and watched the rain. Well after dark, Evan returned, wet and dispirited. Maris was still sitting by the window, in a cold and darkened house.
"You might at least have started a fire," Evan grumbled. His tone was disgusted.
"Oh," she said. She looked at him blankly. "I'm sorry. I didn't think." Evan built the fire. Maris moved to help him, but he snapped at her and chased her out of the way. They ate in silence, but the food seemed to restore Evan's mood. Afterward, he brewed some of his special tea, set a mug down in front of her, and settled into his favourite chair. Maris tasted the steaming tea, conscious of Evan's eyes on her. Finally, she looked up at him.
"How do you feel?" he asked her.
She thought about it. "I feel dead," she said finally.
"Talk about it."
"I can't," she said. She began to weep. "I can't." When the weeping would not stop, Evan fixed her a sleeping draught and put her to bed. The next day, Maris went out. She took a road that Evan had shown her, a well-worn path that led not to the cliffs, but down to the sea itself. And she spent the day walking alone on a cold pebble beach that seemed endless. When she wearied, she rested at the water's edge and flung pebbles into the waves, taking a small, melancholy pleasure in the way they skipped, then sank. Even the sea was different here, she thought. It was grey and cold, without highlights. She missed the flashing blues and greens of the waters around Amberley. Tears ran down her cheeks, and she did not bother to wipe them away. At times she became aware that she was sobbing, without remembering just when or why she had started to cry. The sea was vast and lonely. The empty beach went on forever, and the wild, cloudy sky was all around, but Maris felt hemmed in, suffocated. She thought of all the places in the world that she would never see again, the memory of each one a fresh pain to her. She thought of the impressive ruins of the old fortress on Laos. She remembered Woodwing's Academy, vast and dark, carved into the rock of Seatooth, the Temple of the Sky God on Deeth, the draughty castles of the Flyer Princes of Artelia, the windmills of Stormtown, and the old captain's house, ancient beyond telling, the tree towns of Sethine and Alessi, the boneyards and battlegrounds of Lomeron, the vineyards of the Amberleys, and Rhys's warm, smoky alehouse on Skulney, all lost to her now. And the Eyrie. Ships might take her elsewhere, but the Eyrie was a flyer's place, now closed to her forever. She thought of her friends, scattered over Windhaven like the many islands. Some of them might visit her, but so many others have been snatched out of her world as if they no longer existed. The last time she had seen him, Tamar had been fat and happy in his little stone house on Heaven, teaching his granddaughter to draw the beauty out of a lump of rock. Now he was as dead to her as Halland, a memory, nothing more. She would never see Reed again, nor his beautiful, laughing wife. Never again could she pass the night away drinking Reese's ale and sharing memories of Garth. She'd buy no more wooden trinkets from Smale, nor joke with the cook in that little inn on Poweet. Never again would she watch the flying at the great annual competitions, or sit gossiping and singing among flyers at a party. The memories cut her like a thousand knives, and Maris cried out her pain, sobbing until she could scarcely breathe. She knew how she must look, a ridiculous old woman, weeping and moaning alone on a beach, but she could not stop. She could hardly bear to think of flying itself, of that great joy and freedom she had lost forever. The memories came of themselves, though. The world spread out beneath her, the joy of being winged, the thrill of running before a storm, the myriad colours of the sky, the magnificent solitude of the heights. All the things she could never see or feel again, except in memory. Once she had found a riser that took her halfway to infinity, up to the realms where the star sailors had moved, where the sea itself vanished below and nothing flew but the strange ethereal wind wraiths. She would always remember that day. Always. The world grew dark around her, and the stars began to appear. The sound of the sea was everywhere. She was numb, chilled to the bone, emptied of tears, as she faced the emptiness of her life. Finally, she began the long walk back to the cabin, turning her back on the sea and the sky. The house was warm and filled with the rich aroma of stew. The sight of Evan standing by the fire made her heart beat faster. His blue eyes were infinitely tender when he spoke her name. She ran to him and flung her arms round him, holding tight, holding on for dear life. She closed her eyes against the dizziness. "Maris," he said again. "Maris." He sounded pleased and surprised. His arms came up and held her even more closely, protectively. At last he led her to the table and set her dinner before her. He spoke as they ate, telling her the events of his day. An adventure chasing the goat, finding a bush of ripe silverberries, a special dessert he'd made for her. She nodded, scarcely taking in the sense of what he said, but comforted by the sound of his voice, wanting it to continue. His words, his presence, told her the world had not utterly ended. At last she interrupted him. "Evan, I have to know. This injury I have... is there any chance that it will ever heal? That I will be able... that I will recover?" He set down his spoon, the animation gone out of his face at once. "Maris, I don't know. I don't think anyone could tell you if your condition is a passing thing or permanent. I can't be sure." "Your guess, then. Your best guess." There was pain in his face. "No," he said quietly. "I don't think you'll recover fully. I don't think you can regain what you have lost." She nodded, externally calm. "I understand." She pushed her food aside. "Thank you. I had to ask. Somewhere I was still hoping." She stood up. "Maris," she motioned him back, "I'm tired. It's been a hard day for me, and I have to think, Evan. There are decisions I must make now, and I need to be alone. I'm sorry." She forced a smile. "The stew was fine. I'm sorry to miss the dessert you made, but I'm not hungry." The room was black and cold when Maris woke. The fire she had started had gone out. She sat up in bed and stared into the darkness. "No more tears," she thought. "That's over." When she threw back the covers and stood up, the floor shifted under her feet and she lurched dizzily for an instant. She steadied herself, slipping into a short robe.
and then walked to the kitchen, where she lit a candle from the embers still smouldering in the hearth. The wooden floor was cold beneath her bare feet as she walked down the hall, past the workroom where Evan prepared his brews and ointments, past the empty bedrooms he kept for those who came to him. When she opened his door, Evan stirred, rolled over, and blinked at her.
"Maris?" he said, his voice thick with sleep. "What's wrong?"
"I don't want to be dead," she said. Maris walked across the room and set the candle on the bedside table. Evan sat up and caught her hand.
"I've done all I can for you as a healer," he said. "If you want my love, if you want me..."
She stopped his words with a kiss. "Yes," she said.
"My dear," he said, looking at her in the candlelight.
The shadows made his face strange, and for a moment she felt awkward and frightened, but the moment passed. He threw back his blankets, and she shrugged off her robe and climbed into bed with him. His arms went around her, and his hands were gentle, loving, and familiar, and his body was warm and full of life.
"Teach me to heal," Maris said the next morning. "I'd like to work with you."
Evan smiled.
"Thank you very much," he said. "It's not that easy, you know. Why this sudden interest in the healing arts?"
She frowned.
"I must do something, Evan. I have only one skill, flying, and that's lost to me now. I've never done anything else. I could take a ship back to Amberley and live out the rest of my days in the house I inherited from my stepfather, doing nothing. I'd be provided for. Even if I had nothing, the people of Amberley don't let their retired flyers end as paupers."
She moved away from the breakfast table and began to pace.
"Or I could stay here, if there's something for me to do."
"If I don't find something to fill my days, something useful, my memories will drive me mad, Evan. I'm past my childbearing years. I decided against motherhood years ago. I can't sail a ship or carry a tune or build a house. The gardens I began always died. I'm hopeless at mending, and being cooped up in a shop selling things all day would drive me to drink."
"I see you've considered all the options," Evan said, the ghost of a smile about his lips.
"Yes, I have," Maris said seriously. "I don't know that I would have any skills as a healer. There's no reason for me to think so. But I'm willing to work hard, and I've got a flyer's memory. I wouldn't be likely to confuse poisons with healing potions. I can help you gather herbs, mix remedies, hold down your victims while you cut them up or whatever. I've assisted at 2 births. I would do whatever you told me, whatever you needed another pair of hands for."
"I've worked alone for a long time, Maris. I have no patience with clumsiness or ignorance or mistakes."
Maris smiled at him. "Or opinions that contradict your own."
He laughed. "Yes. I suppose I could teach you, and I could use your help. But I don't know if I believe this 'I'll do whatever you say' of yours. You're starting a bit late in life to be a humble servant."
She looked at him, trying not to show the sudden panic she felt. If he refused her, what could she do? She felt like begging him to let her stay. He must have seen something of this in her face, for he caught hold of her hand and held it tightly.
"We'll try it," he said. "If you are willing to try to learn, I am surely willing to teach. It is time I passed some of my learning on to someone else, so that if I am bitten by a blue tick or seized with liar's fever, everything will not be lost by my death."
Maris smiled her relief.
"How do we start?"
Evan thought a moment.
"There are small villages and encampments in the forest that I haven't visited in half a year. We'll travel for a week or two, making the rounds, and you'll gain some idea of what I do. And we'll learn if you have the stomach for it."
He released her hand and stood up, walking toward the storeroom.
"Come help me pack."
Maris learnt many things during her travels with Evan through the forest, few of them pleasant. It was hard work. Evan, so patient a healer, was a demanding teacher. But Maris was glad of it. It was good to be pushed to her limits,
to work until she could work no longer. She had no time to think of her own loss, and she slept deeply every night. But while she was pleased to be of use and gladly performed the tasks Evan set her, other requirements of this new life were harder for Marys to fulfill. It was difficult enough to comfort strangers, more difficult still when there was no comfort to be offered. Marys had nightmares about one woman whose child died. It was Evan who told her, of course, but it was to Marys the woman turned in her sorrow and her rage, refusing to believe, demanding a miracle that no one could give. Marys marvelled that Evan could give of himself so steadily and absorb so much pain, fear and grief, year after year, without breaking. She tried to copy his calm and his firm, gentle manner, reminding herself that he had called her strong. Marys wondered if she would gain more skill and inner certainty with time. Evan at times seemed to know what to do by instinct, Marys thought, just as some woodwingers took to the air as if born to it, while others struggled hopelessly, lacking that special feel for the air. Evan's very touch could soothe an ailing person, but Marys had no such gift. As night began to fall on the 19th day of their travels, Marys and Evan did not stop to make camp, but only walked more quickly. Even Marys, to whom all trees looked alike, recognized this part of the forest. Soon Evan's house came into sight. Suddenly Evan caught her wrist, stopping her. He was staring ahead at the house. There was a light shining in the window, and smoke rising from the chimney. A friend? She hazarded. Someone who needs your help? Perhaps, Evan said quietly. But there are others. The homeless. People driven from their villages because of some crime or madness. They attack travelers, or break into houses and wait. They approached the house quietly, Evan in the lead going for the lighted window rather than the door. A man and a child. Doesn't look bad, murmured Evan. It was a high window. Standing on the tips of her toes, leaning on Evan for support, Marys could just see in. She saw a large, ruddy, bearded man sitting on a stool before the fire. At his feet sat a child, looking up into his face. The man turned his head slightly, and the firelight brought out a glint of red in his dark hair. She saw his face in the light. "Cole!" she cried, joyful. She tottered and nearly fell, but Evan caught her. "Your brother?" "Yes!" She ran around the side of the house, and as she laid her hand on the door pull, it opened from within, and Cole caught her up in a big bear hug. Marys was always surprised by the size of her stepbrother. She saw him usually at intervals of years, and in between thought of him as young Cole, her little brother, thin, awkward, and undeveloped, at ease only with a guitar in his hand, when he could transcend himself by singing. But her little brother had filled out and grown into his height. Years of travel, earning passage to other islands by working as a sailor and labouring at whatever task came to hand when his audience was too poor to pay for his songs, had strengthened him. His hair, once red gold, had darkened mostly to brown. The red showed only in his beard now, and in firelit glints. "You are Evan, the healer?" Cole asked, turning to Evan. He held Marys in the crook of one arm. At Evan's nod, he went on. "I'm sorry to seem so rude, but we were told in Port Deos that Marys was living here with you. We've been waiting these past 4 days for you. I broke a shutter to get in, but I've repaired it. I think you'll find it even better now." He looked down at Marys and hugged her again. "I was afraid we'd missed you, that you'd flown away again." Marys stiffened. She saw the quick concern on Evan's face and shook her head at him very slightly. "We'll talk," she said. "Let's sit by the fire. My legs are nearly worn off from walking. Evan, will you make your wonderful tea?" "I've brought kivas," Cole said quickly. "3 bottles, traded for a song. Shall I heat one?"
That would be lovely, Maris said.
As she moved toward the cupboard where the heavy pottery mugs were kept, she caught sight of the child again, half hiding in the shadows, and stopped short.
Barry? She asked, wonderingly.
The little girl came forward shyly, head hanging, looking up with a sideways glance.
Barry, Maris said again, warmth in her tone. It is you. I'm your Aunt Maris.
She bent to hug the child, then drew back again to take a better look. You couldn't remember me, of course. You were no bigger than a burrow bird when I last saw you.
My father sings about you, Barry said. Her voice rang clearly bell-like.
And do you sing too? Maris asked. Barry shrugged awkwardly and looked at the floor.
Sometimes, she muttered.
Barry was a thin, fine-boned child of about 8 years. Her light brown hair was cropped short, lying like a sleek cap on her head, framing a freckled, heart-shaped face with wide grey eyes. She was dressed like a smaller version of her father, in a belted woolen tunic over leather pants. A piece of hardened resin, a clear golden colour, hung on a thong around her neck.
"Why don't you bring some cushions and blankets near the fire so we can all be comfortable?" Maris suggested. "They're kept in that wooden chest in the far corner."
She got the mugs and returned to the fireside. Cole caught her hand and pulled her down beside him.
"It's so good to see you walking. Healed," he said, in his deep, warm voice. "When I heard of your fall, I was worried you'd be crippled, like Father. All the long journey here from Poeet, I kept hoping for more news, better news, and hearing none. They said that it was a terrible fall, onto rock, that both your legs and arms were broken. But now, better than any report, I see your whole. How long before you fly back to Amberley?"
Maris looked into the eyes of the man who, although not blood kin, she had loved as a brother for more than 40 years. "I'll never go back to Amberley, Col," she said. Her voice was even. "I'll never fly again. I was hurt more badly than I knew in that fall. My arm and my legs mended, but something else stayed broken. When I hit my head, my sense of balance has gone wrong. I can't fly." He stared at her, the happiness draining out of his face. He shook his head.
"Maris, no."
"There's no use saying no any more," she said. "I've had to accept it."
"Isn't there something—"
To Maris's relief, Evan interrupted. "There's nothing. We've done all we can, Maris and I. Injuries to the head are mysterious. We don't even know what exactly happened, and there's no healer anywhere on Windhaven, I'd wager, who would know what to do to fix it."
Cole nodded, looking dazed. "I didn't mean to imply— It's just so hard for me to accept. Maris, I can't imagine you grounded."
He meant well, Maris knew, but his grief and incomprehension grated against her, tore her wounds open again.
"You don't have to imagine it," she said rather sharply. "This is my life now, for anyone to see. The wings have already been taken back to Amberley."
Cole said nothing. Maris didn't want to see the pain on his face, so she stared into the fire and let the silence grow. She heard the sound of a stone bottle being unstoppered, and then Evan was pouring the steaming kivas into 3 mugs.
"Can I taste?"
Barry crouched beside her father, looking up, hopeful. Cole smiled down at her and shook his head teasingly. Watching the father and daughter together, Maris felt the tension suddenly dissolve. She met Evan's eyes as he put a mug filled with the hot spiced wine into her hands and smiled. She turned back to Cole and was about to speak to him when her eyes fell on his guitar, which lay, as always, close to hand. The sight of it released a torrent of memories, and suddenly Maris felt that Barion, dead now for many years, was again in the room with them. The guitar had been his, and he had claimed it had been in his family for generations, passed down from the days of the Star Sailors. She had never known whether or not to believe him. Exaggerations and beautiful lies came from him as easily as breathing, but certainly the instrument was very old. He had entrusted it to Cole, who had been his protégé and the son he'd never had. Maris reached out to feel the smooth wood, dark with many varnishings and constant handling.
"Sing for us, Cole," she suggested.
"Sing us something new." The guitar was in his arms, cradled against his chest, almost before the words were out of her mouth. The soft chord sounded.
"I call this the singer's lament," he said, a wry smile on his face.
And he began to sing a song, melancholy and ironic in turns, about a singer whose wife leaves him because he loves his music too well. Maris suspected it was his own marriage he was singing of, although he had never told her why it had ended, and she had not been around to see much of it firsthand. The recurring refrain of the song was, "A singer should not marry, a singer should not wed, just kiss the music as she flies and take a song to bed." Next, he sang a song about the turbulent love affair between a proud landsman and an even prouder one-wing. Maris recognized one of the names, but had not heard the story. "Is that true?" she asked when the song had ended. Cole laughed.
"I remember you used to ask that same question of Barion. I'll give you his answer. I can't tell you when or where or if it happened, but it's a true story all the same."
"Now sing my song," Barry said.
Cole dropped a kiss on his daughter's nose and sang a tuneful fantasy about a little girl named Barry who makes friends with a Scylla, who takes her to find treasure in a cave beneath the sea. Later, he sang older songs. The Ballad of Aaron and Jenny, the song about the ghost flyers, the one about the mad landsman of Kennehut, his own version of the woodwing's song. Later still, when Barry had been put to bed, and the three adults were working on the third bottle of kvass, they spoke about their lives. More calmly now, Maris could talk to Cole about her decision to stay with Evan. The first shock passed. Cole knew better than to express pity for her, but he let her know he did not understand the choice she had made.
"But why stay here in Eastern, far from all your friends?"
Then, with drunken courtesy, he added, "I don't mean to slight you, Evan." "Anywhere I chose to live would be far from someone," Maris said. "You know how widely my friends are scattered." She sipped the hot, intoxicating drink, feeling detached. "Come with me back to Amberley," he coaxed. "Live in the house we grew up in. We might wait a while, for spring when the sea is calmer, but the voyage is not so bad between here and there, truly."
"You can have the house," she said. "You and Barry can live there. Or sell it if you like.
I can't go and live there again. There are too many memories there.
Here on Theos I can start a new life. It will be hard, but Evan helps me."
She took his hand.
"I can't stand idleness. It's good to be useful."
"But as a healer?" Cole shook his head.
"It's odd to think of you doing that."
He looked to Evan.
"Hey, is she any good?"
"Truthfully."
Evan held Maris's hand between his own, stroking it. "She learns quickly," he said after a few moments' thought. "She has a strong desire to help, and does not balk at dull or difficult tasks. I don't know yet whether she has it in her to be a healer, if she will ever be truly skilled. But I must admit, quite selfishly, I'm glad she's here. I hope she'll never want to leave me." A flush rose to her cheeks, and Maris bent her head and drank. She was startled, yet gratified by his last words. There'd been very little in the way of love talk between her and Evan, no romantic promises or extravagant claims or compliments, and although she had tried to put it out of her mind, somewhere within she feared that she had given Evan no choice in their relationship, that she had installed herself in his life before he could have any second thoughts. But there had been love in his voice. There was a silence. To fill it, Maris asked Cole about Barry. "When did she start travelling with you?"
"'It's been about 6 months,' he said.
He set his mug down, drained, and picked up his guitar. He stroked the strings, producing faint chords as he spoke.
"'Her mother's new husband is a violent man. He beat Barry once. Her mother wouldn't say no to him. But she had no objections to my taking her away. She told me he might be jealous of Barry. He's been trying to get a child of his own.
How does Barry feel?
She's glad to be with me, I think. She's a quiet little thing. She misses her mother, I know, but she's glad to be out of that household where nothing she did was right.
Are you making a singer of her, then? Evan asked.
If she wants to be. I knew when I was younger than she. But Barry doesn't know yet what she wants to do with her life. She sings like a little chime bird. But there's more to being a singer than singing other people's songs, and she's shown no talent yet for making up her own.
She's very young, said Maris.
Cole shrugged and set his guitar aside again. Yes, there's time. I don't press her.
He blinked and yawned hugely.
Must be past my bedtime. I'll show you to a room, Evan said.
Cole laughed and shook his head.
No need, he said. After 4 days, I feel quite at home here.
He stood, and Maris also rose, gathering up the empty mugs. She kissed Cole goodnight, and then lingered as Evan banked the fire and straightened the furniture, waiting to walk hand in hand with him to the bed they shared. For the next few days, Cole kept Maris's spirits high. They were together constantly, and he told her stories of his adventures and sang to her. In all the years since Cole had first gone wandering with Barion and Maris had become a full-fledged flyer, they'd not spent much time together. Now, as the days passed and Cole and Barry lingered, they grew closer than they had been since Cole's boyhood. He spoke for the first time of his failed marriage and his feeling that it was his fault for being so much away from home. Maris did not speak of her accident or her unhappiness. But there was no need. Cole knew all too well what the wings had meant to her. As the days merged almost imperceptibly into weeks, Cole and Barry stayed on. Cole travelled abroad to sing at the inns in Thossey and Port Theos, while Barry began trailing after Evan. She was quiet, unobtrusive, and attentive, and Evan was pleased by her interest. The four of them lived comfortably together, taking turns with the chores and gathering together in the evenings for stories or games before the fire. Maris told Evan, told Cole, told herself that she was contented. She thought of no other life. Then one day, Srella arrived. Maris was alone in the house that afternoon, and she answered the knocking on the door. Her first response was one of pleasure at the sight of her old friend, but even as she opened her arms to embrace, Maris felt her eyes drawn to the wings Srella carried slung over one arm, and her heart lurched painfully. As she led Srella to a chair near the fire and put the kettle on for tea, she was thinking dully, "Soon she'll fly away again and leave me." It required a great effort for her to seat herself beside Srella and ask with a show of interest for news. Srella's face was shining with barely repressed excitement.
"I've come here on business," she said. "I've come with a message for you. I've come to ask you, to invite you, to make the voyage to Seatooth and live there as the new head of the academy. They need a strong, permanent teacher at Woodwings. Not like the ones who have come and gone over the past 6 years. Someone committed, someone knowledgeable, a leader. You, Maris. Everyone looks up to you. There could be no one better than you for the job. We all want you there."
Maris thought of Sina, dead nearly 15 years now, as she had been in the last years of her very long life. The fallen, crippled flyer, standing on the cliff at Woodwings, shouting herself hoarse as she tried to convey her knowledge of flight to the young woodwingers circling in the air above her. Never to fly again herself, permanently grounded with one almost useless leg and one blind milk-white eye. Forever standing below,
staring fiercely into the storm winds, watching the woodwingers fly away from her year after year, all those years, until she finally died. How had she borne it? A deep shudder went through Maris, and she shook her head wildly.
Maris, Srella sounded bewildered. You've always been the staunchest supporter of woodwings, of the whole system. There is still so much you could do. What's wrong?
Maris stared at her, goaded, wanting to scream. She said very softly,
How can you ask that?
But, Srella spread her hands,
What can you do here? Maris, I know how you feel, believe me. But your life isn't over. I remember that once you told me that we flyers, were your family. We still are. It's foolish to exile yourself like this. Come back. You need us now, and we still need you. Woodwings is your place. Without you, it could never have existed. Don't turn your back on it now.
You don't understand, Maris said. How could you? You can still fly. Srella reached out and took Maris's hand and held it, even though it remained limp, not answering her pressure.
I'm trying to understand, she said. I know how you must be suffering. Believe me, ever since I heard the news, I've thought about what my life would be if I were injured. I've been grounded for a year at times, you know? So I have some idea, even though I've never had to come to terms with the idea of its being permanent. Everyone has to think about it. The end comes for all flyers, you know? Sometimes it comes in competition, sometimes in injury, often just in age.
I always thought I would die, Maris said quietly. I never thought about going on living and being unable to fly.
Srella nodded. I know, she said. But now it has happened, and you have to adjust to it.
I am, Maris said.
I was.
She pulled her hand away. I've made a new life for myself here. If you hadn't come, if I could just forget. She saw by the quick flash of pain in Srella's face that she had wounded her friend. But Srella shook her head and looked determined.
You can't forget, she said. That's hopeless. You have to go on, to do the things you can do. Come and teach at Woodwings. Stay close to your friends. Hiding here, you're just pretending.
All right, it's pretense, Maris said harshly. She stood up and walked to the window where she looked blindly out at the wet blur of brown and green that was the forest. It's a pretense I need in order to go on living. I can't bear the constant reminder of what I've lost. When I saw you standing in the doorway, all I could think of was your wings and how I wished I could strap them on and fly away from here. I thought I'd stop thinking about that. I thought I'd settle down here. I love Evan. And I'm learning a lot as his assistant. I'm doing something useful. I've been enjoying having Col around and getting to know his daughter. And the sight of one pair of wings sweeps it all away, turns my life to dust.
Silence filled the cabin. Finally, Maris turned away from the window to look at Srella. She saw the tears on her friend's face, but also the look of stubborn disapproval.
All right, Maris said, sighing. Tell me I'm wrong.
Tell me what you think.
I think, said Srella, that what you are doing is wrong. I think you are making things harder for yourself in the long run. You can't wipe out your life as if it never was. You don't live in a world without flyers. You may hide here and pretend to be an assistant healer, but you can never really forget that you were, that you are, a flyer. We still need you. There's still a life for you. You haven't come to terms with your life yet. You're still avoiding it. Come to Woodwings, Maris.
No.
No, no. Srella, I couldn't bear it. You may be right, and what I'm doing may be wrong, but I've thought about it, and it's the only thing I can do. I can't bear the pain. I have to go on living, and to do that I must forget what I've lost or I'll go mad.
You don't know.
I couldn't bear to see them all flying around me, rejoicing in the air, and to know that I could never again join them. Forever to be reminded of what I've lost. I can't. Woodwings will survive without me. I can't go back there.
She stopped, shaking with intensity, with fear, with the renewed reminder of her loss. Srella rose and held her until the shaking passed.
All right, Srella said softly. I won't press you. I have no right to tell you what you should do. But if you should change your mind, if you think about it again when more time has passed, I know the position would always be open to you. It's your decision. I won't mention it again.